What? Oh, what's the problem now? Do you know what the fuck you're doing? Do I have to get somebody in here to actually find out what's going on so that they can replace you and I have actually somebody that I can work with who's competent?
We get unusual peaking.
That's what she said. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes referred to as the creepy guy down the street that you kids don't talk to, all right?
Creepy guy down the street that the kids don't talk to.
All right.
You set me up for that one.
No, you don't have to repeat that. I don't want you to repeat things. What was I saying? We are coming to you far away from the downtown metropolis area. You see what you did
is that you kind of
you ruined the joke by doing that. Did you understand that?
So I gotta know when I'm to repeat the thing that you say.
Well, yeah, that's not a repeat thing.
It's always been a repeat thing in the past.
Not really. If you have like one word at the end and it's like, I can.
I didn't
repeat
read the
that.
Rules. That's a thing.
Well, you don't use your common sense. And that's what God gave you was common sense, and it's the thing you use the least.
I piss on common sense.
Anyways, we're coming to you far away from the downtown. But that still gets me mad. Excuse me, folks. This is going to be a long show because that was a good joke.
It was
good,
and it was going into something really good.
It was a good joke.
Damn it.
I don't like when he wrecks my jokes because it's not easy to come up with this shit. And yet he did.
But now you gotta wait another week. Sorry.
Now you gotta wait another week. Okay. So, downtown Montreal, whatever. Close enough to the city after the show, whatever. Okay.
We're here.
Now I'm only gonna give half-ass show. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna give a half-ass show today.
All right, I'm gonna do my Senator Bob voice.
No, I don't want you doing anything anymore.
You don't think that's appropriate for...
I don't want you doing anything anymore. Okay. You have bummed me out.
I'm gonna sit here and play air guitar.
Anyway, we love our listeners, though.
That
who,
we do.
Who have already turned to the gardening the show. But now, speaking of Rob, which we haven't really up till this point.
Nope.
It's been an interesting week as Rob was accused by the Jewish Defense League of being anti-Semitic. Because he said in a print interview in one of the local papers... That he was anti-Semitic when in fact Rob said he was anti-semantics.
Anti-semantics.
Yeah, he hates semantics.
Oh, okay.
And you've always hated semantics, haven't you?
Drive me nuts.
Drive me nuts. So we had a firestorm this week of people calling you anti-Semitic. When they just misunderstood, the paper put it as Semitic, but you meant anti-Semitic.
Yeah, so...
There should be no semantics in the world, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and then this firestorm is undeserved.
It is undeserved. You love all Jewish people.
Well, no, I don't love anyone.
Yeah, that's it. So he's anti-everybody.
I'm anti
And semantics.
I hate semantics more than everybody.
They're not actually people, you know that, right?
Okay. I can hate them more.
You realize that, right? They're not people. Okay.
Damn semantics. The island of Samantia.
Now, today on the show, even though I don't think we have too many listeners left right now.
Not too many.
And it all started from you interrupting my good joke.
I do that.
Well, don't.
It's a thing I do.
And it's a thing I do to keep bringing it up instead of going to the show. Because it just unnerves me. Just, it's like you work really hard on a joke, and it's really funny, and then you go and say, dum 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 dum.
Aren't I funny?
Yeah. Now, today on the show, we start our three-part theme on albums produced by the great Todd Rundgren, who... everybody knows Todd Rundgren. If you don't, I'm not going to explain all that.
He's a good guy.
I got to explain a lot of other stuff on the show. Yeah, he's a good guy. He did this and he did that, and I love it. And we start with a review of the 1977 album by a man I think you know called Meatloaf.
Meatloaf.
And an album called Bad Outta Hell, or originally called Cat From Hell.
Cat From Hell. But the record company made him change. The record company made him change the name a few times.
Cat From Hell. Didn't sound as menacing as Bad Outta Hell.
Rat Outta Hell, kind of, but not.
Now, speaking of being from hell, Rob, how was your week?
It was a rainy, rainy week.
It was rainy this week, wasn't it? It was
rainy. Yeah, I got wet.
We complained last week about it was too hot.
Too hot, yeah.
This week it's been all rain.
So we're going to complain about the weather, no matter what the weather is. If it's hail, if it's quiet, calm fog, it doesn't matter. Complaints we're going to
raise. Actually, we did complain about the weather last week because it was too hot. But we also got a storm after the show.
Yeah.
So that's, you see, but I like storms, so I wasn't complaining about it. Except I heard, because we're not in the city, we drive back into the city after the show. I heard that while we did the show, they had one hell of a rain, of a hailstorm. Very vicious one.
A real whopper.
And we missed it because we're like 15 minutes from the city. Yeah. So there you go. Anyways, how was your week?
The week was pretty good. What the heck happened? I didn't work too much because of the rain, but then it's not going to rain the weekend. So I'll probably make up the work on the hours there on the weekend.
And, that's fantastic. Odds and ends. Odds and ends. Lost time is not found again. Now, we haven't done this in a while. Nope. But we have some catching up to do, and that is what this segment is about. This segment should be called Odds and Ends Catching Up to Do.
Yeah.
See, when I want him to speak, he's like, hey, man, yeah.
Yeah. You said it, brother.
And the first topic I have is I wanted to mention about... not that we didn't talk about it enough last week, like we dedicated like 45 minutes to Robbie Robertson and the band last week. There was a couple things I wanted to talk about. And that was first time I saw the band. I saw the band, actually, they taped a special when they were had their reunion. They got together and had a tour in 1983, as I said last week. And that's when I bought the first album I ever bought from the band, called Stage Fright, was because I bought it just before that concert. I didn't go because nobody I knew was going. Nobody was into the band at that point.
Nobody knew who the band was.
Well, we knew who the band was. They knew who the band was. They were not, they had been out of the spotlight
for quite
a while.
Yeah, they didn't have any current hits.
Yeah, they didn't have any current hits. So nobody really wanted to go. So, and I didn't know that much about, to be honest with you, I didn't know that much about the band other than the couple of songs I had heard on the radio at that time. So what they did was that I got a couple of big clues today about where we are, where we tape our show. Where we're from.
Big clue.
And if you can figure it out, email me at soundsfromthe70s@gmail.com. And we will actually give you a pretty good prize if you can guess it.
Am I eligible?
No, because you're an idiot.
Okay, if you're an idiot, you're not eligible.
The band,
oh, that's just me.
You're a special kind of idiot. The band played here in concert. Then they played their next show, and that was the show that they taped their concert at. And it showed on TV, on pay TV here in Canada in 1984 for 2 hours. And I watched that. Now, I don't know why you're making that face. What the hell's wrong with you?
I'm trying to remember, and I have no memory. Oh. Therefore, I didn't see it.
It didn't play that many times, to be honest with you. But anyways, the show was 2 hours long, and it was interesting because they had the music, and then they had a lot of interviews with the guys of the band. And you can get it on DVD, or used to get it on VHS tape, but it was always edited. It was always... The full 2-hour show that I saw, they've always edited it down to about 90 minutes. And they took some songs out and they took some interviews out.
Why would they do that?
I don't know why they do stuff like that. It was quite an interesting, but I don't remember being that captivated by the music. First of all, I watched it later on, probably again in the edited form. 10 years later, it was very watered down, and didn't have the energy. It took two guys, by the way, to replace Robbie Robertson, and still they couldn't replace him. And I didn't like the show much. I think I did at the time because I didn't know their music very well, and I liked it talking to the guys in the band who I didn't know very well, except for Robbie Robertson, and he wasn't there. But it seemed to be a very enjoyable show. Of course, like a year later, I watched The Last Waltz, and then I became a band fanatic. But at that time, I wasn't. If you can ever catch on bootleg DVD, the two-hour version, which is very hard to find, you should watch that just to see what it was like. But that was the first time I saw them. Now, the second time I saw the band was actually live in concert in 1994. And you could really find out where we taped this show, because it was the day after the World Cup. I remember that. It was a day after the World Cup in 1994. I forget who won. Brazil. Let's just say Brazil.
Yeah.
I think it was Brazil, actually, that won. The won the World Cup in 94. And the day after, they played here. And all my friends who, by that point, were really big band fans, like me, there's about six of us, we went down, and they played the Convention Center. And it wasn't just me. It was one of the worst, if not, it was definitely the most biggest disappointment I've ever seen in any concert, if not the worst concert I've seen. And the reason is, and I think I would have said this in 1983 if I was there to see it in person. First of all, it was 75 minutes long, and then there was a couple of encores. That's bullshit. It was costly tickets. And they only played the regular set for 75 minutes. I was upset. And they didn't have a lot of emotion when they played their songs. A lot of them were speeded up. And we were like, I remember we were looking at each other because we were at a table. It was kind of like they set it up for tables instead of like chairs, right? Okay. So you had a table and you were sitting around a table. And we were looking at each other like, "Ooh, this is bad. Like this is not good versions. These are very unemotional, just running through the set list type of versions." And we were just like, "I can't believe how bad this show is." And I hate to end this on a bum note, but I'm just telling you what a difference like one band member makes. Like, and when you get together more like for the wrong reasons, instead of being, although they were promoting their new album, their album at the time, Jericho, was actually an excellent album. The only really good album that they made without Robbie Robertson. And, but they didn't really use much of their material. Everything was, there was a couple of songs written by them, but most of it was other people's material. And, I don't know, it was sad. I remember it's one of the saddest experiences I've ever had going to a concert. It was extremely sad that we had to experience it. It was as bad as I'm saying, and probably worse. I mean, we went home that night just like nobody said a word, like, oh, that was so bad. And
you guys never talked about it again.
You know, we never did. Never did. You don't talk about bad concerts that much.
No, nope. Bad movies, bad concerts. Yeah. You get on with it.
And so that was my experience. I just want to tell you my experience, like first ever seeing the band, and then the one time I got to see them in concert. Of course, I would have loved to have seen the original band play, but I would have been very young. Yeah. Very young. I also want to talk about, I just wanted to get that out of the way. Nothing really big about what I was, just feel better that I said everything that I wanted to say.
It's all out of your system, though.
Yes, I got it out of my system. I want to talk about, we got a couple of recent big box set releases. I think I mentioned this one way a couple of shows ago about the Who releasing Who's Next is one of them. And I tell you, these box sets are just getting crazy. Just kidding. This one, the Who are releasing Who's Next on a box set, and it's 10 CDs and a Blu-ray. And that's 11.
Wow.
That's 11.
Wow. CDs.
And I'm going like, what the fuck?
What do they have to say there? Like,
that's what I was thinking. I mean, how much do you have to say about that album? About a 40-minute album in 11 CDs. Like, holy fuck. I have to... I will say that it's got... Like, I don't think all this stuff is needed because it's just made to make the people who have money to buy it. And unfortunately, the people who don't have money can't get all these nice things.
No, of course. They can get like... It's a luxury item.
Yeah, exactly. No. They got a nice... graphic novel about Lifehouse, which is what Who's Next is based on. It's a 170-page hardback book inside the box set. You get a big 20x30 poster of a Who gig in England on May 7th, 1970. You get another poster, blah, blah, blah. A 20-page concert program from the Rainbow Theatre in London on 4th of November, 1971. You get another program from the band's October to November 1971 tour of the UK. You get a 4 pit and button set and an 8x10 color photo of the Who with printed autographs. That's nice, but I don't want to pay money for that. I wouldn't pay money for that if it was like just for sale for $5 or 10. Well, 10 bucks would be, or 5 yeah, bucks would be a nice price. Yeah, it was
a reasonable price.
Yeah, separately, I would probably buy that. So what they have, music-wise, is a 2-CD set. The first set would be the album, remastered. Of course, everything's got to be remastered. I don't know what's wrong with the original mastering. There's a second disc offering highlights of sessions, demos, jingles, live, blah, bee, boo. if everybody understood that. Let me just go... can I just check this for a second, Rob?
Please, by me. My curiosity must be satisfied.
Do you mind if I do that? Yeah, the second one. Oh no, the CD2. CD2 is the demos. Now that would be interesting. I'm not quibbling about the music. I'm just quibbling about how much of this steams out. They got all these great demos by Pete Townsend on CD2. On CD3 is part two of all the demos that he did around this time. CD4 is the sessions they did in New York that didn't really end up, I don't think, on the album. Kind of interesting. CD5 is some more sessions. Fuck, how much can you listen to songs from an album? That's the point of like huge box sets. Is how, and we're going to get to that in a minute when I talk about something else about listening to songs over and over again. Okay, so you've got the sessions in London, same songs except, okay, they're doing it in London now. And then CD6 is the singles and the B-sides. And, oh, the original single mix. And, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the Who. They always remix everything. And then they say, oh, here's the original mix for a little extra money. And then there on CD7 and 8 is a full concert that they did in 1971. That's kind of cool. I got nothing against that. And CD9... and 10 are actually a full concert they did also in San Francisco in 1971. So there's a lot of music. I think a lot of unnecessary music. A lot of music just to gorge people with. I wouldn't mind if you had a choice. Like if you said, oh, we got this concert from San Francisco. Let's see if it sells by itself for $15 or whatever on a CD. And but to put
pretty
it in this.
Clever.
Because I'm going to tell you how much this is going to cost.
I'm
going to
guess more than $500 American. That's my guess.
You'd be very close. Let me see this.
More, not less.
If you paid for this in Canada, because we're in Canada, so we're going to use our denomination, it would be almost very close to $400.
Wowee.
$400 fucking. And if you didn't want the 10 CDs, they kind of say, fuck you, you get 2 CDs. So it's not like, oh, you get 4 or 5 CDs if you want a budget. No, it's either like 11 CDs, because it's the Blu-ray, which has a lot of stuff. It's like, you get all of this if you got enough money and we love you. And if not, well, we'll just give you two CDs and... Ugh.
Here, get the hell out of here.
Get the hell out of here. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, there are some places that have it as high as right. Rob is right. It's $500. Holy smokes. Wow. Okay, now we're going to talk about, since we talked about that, another one that is going to be released that was just announced this week. And they're by a group that me and Rob love, but I never understand what they do because of Robert Fripp. But King Crimson are celebrating the 50th anniversary of their classic 1973 album, Larks, Tongues, and Aspic, with the complete recorded sessions, which means everything that was recorded, every take, everything... is put into this. And as it says, the complete recordings of every session recorded for the album. Holy fuck. Is this... I don't know. And I seriously don't know, because King Crimson and Robert Fripp, you know, Robert Fripp, you never know if he's... Because he does release these box sets, right, of every concert they did at during Larks, Tongues, and Aspic, which he has. So you get the album, and then you get various mixes, and then you'll get like 15 concerts that they have taped, and whatever, could be 30 concerts, and then it's like $500, and then you go, and he does that. Like, I think almost every concert is available from the original King Crimson, from 69 to 75, and. The point that I don't know, is he doing this so all his fans can have music, or is it kind of like a joke? Like, yeah, we're going to release everything and charge $500 and see if kind of like sarcasm. You know, are you going to really buy this? You're going to really buy every single take we do? Are you going to really buy every single concert that we made?
Well, if we were going to offer every single recording we did for that album, this is how much it would cost.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know if it's being serious or it's being like, yeah, you know what? You've always wanted bootlegs and stuff, so we're going to put out everything and just see if you buy it. And so I don't know if it's a joke. Anyways, it's being released in October. I want to see how many things are on here. How many things? Actually, a lot of stuff on the Blu-ray. There's two Blu-rays and there's two CDs. Now, you can fit a lot on a Blu-ray, so that's why there's a lot of music on here. And there's a lot, just like Larks 1 takes 1 to 10. Larks 1 takes 12 to 18 and 20 to 22. Fuck, man. Like,
they should be getting them in 2-3 takes, tops.
And you know what? You know what bugs me about this, Rob, is I think it diminishes the album. Not only by, and I don't mean by hearing the takes in an inferior form or in a working stage. That's quite interesting in some ways. But it's just hearing them. I don't think people are meant... The general public are meant to hear a band record the songs over. I would never want to hear our stuff over and over. All the takes that we do. Like, you people have no idea how many times we have to hear these songs when we record them and mix them and do overdubs. And oh my God, we got to hear them hundreds of times. And this is just like that. And I think it diminishes the original record because you don't look at it the same anymore. Because you've heard now these songs in like 40 takes.
Yeah, you know, maybe this is only for people who've heard the album so many times they're sick of it.
Sick of it or know it to the point where they want to know more.
It could be, yeah, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm just looking at all these February 1st, 1973, the whole sessions that day. And I'm surprised, and you can fit a whole lot of music. So this would be an equivalent of, I don't know, 8 CDs, because you're fitting it onto Blu-rays, which can fit a whole bunch of stuff.
A million albums.
You know what you, but it's economically priced. It's about, £45, pounds, which would be about $90, which is a hell of a lot better than the $400 for the Who's Next. But this whole thing about just releasing everything and releasing as much music as you possibly can is not, it doesn't add to the music. I feel it detracts from the original album, especially a 40-minute album.
Only the hardcore nutso fans are
They're for the hardcore nutso fans. And I feel like, I don't know, I don't know Robert Fripp. I just know his reputation. I just feel it's a little bit of an in-joke on him, you know? Very English cerebral in-joke. But the other bands don't. Like, the Who's... Like, I'm surprised with the Who and their 11 CDs. Like, it's very surprising. I think most was five before for Quadrophenia or something like that. That made sense because they had the two CDs for Quadrophenia itself and the two CDs for all of Pete's demos and then another CD of something else. And that made sense. And it was like, oh, okay. But when you get into 10 and 11 CDs and then you're talking about myriad versions of the same song, it really diminishes an album. Who's next is supposed to be 40 minutes for a reason, you know, and once you extend it to 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, wow.
Weren't there some outtakes from that album? I'm trying to think. I had an old songbook, and it had one song on it, but I haven't. It might have been on Odds and
Sides. Well, there was B-sides that were used as B-sides that were outtakes from the sessions. And there was a lot of songs from Lifehouse, which is what Who's Next was based from. So there were songs that were not used on Who's Next that I think a couple of them went on the Odds and Sods album.
Okay, that's the
end. Yeah, and that's, I think, what you're thinking of.
One song is a Pure and Easy, which
yes, that was definitely, that was the centerpiece actually of the not the Who's Next album, but the Lifehouse project.
The Lifehouse project,
yeah, that's a great song.
To hear it one of these days.
What'd you say to me?
I said you look like you're in a haze.
No, I didn't hear what you said. What did you say?
I said I have to hear it one of these days.
Oh, okay, okay.
I've only ever seen it on paper.
So I just wanted to bring that up. Things, and I just saw today. Just today, as I was getting the tabs ready and everything for the show, as we're taping this show today, I just got announced that Prince is releasing like 8 CDs of his Diamonds and Pearls album. And I'm going like, this is, I don't think that's very rock and roll. I remember it used to be thought of, and I've told this before, like in jazz, they would do that. They released like 8. You know, 5 CDs and 6 and yeah, 7 CDs. And they'd concerts, be very academic.
They
you know?
Play differently, so yeah.
And they play differently. And I just don't think it's very rock and roll. And but they keep on doing it. And they'll do it until people stop buying it, I guess. The people who are our age but have money, and the people who are our age who don't have money, understand what we're talking about. I think the rock and roll has never, up until this surge of CD box sets, has never been elitist. It has always been, this is how much it is, and music is for everybody. Now it's not like that. It's like music if you got money, and here's something if you don't. It's kind of bullshit, but you don't have money, you fucks. And we could get into that in a whole subject that I don't have time for. But you can see how I feel about it already by my one simple statement that saying that this is okay for our real fans. Sorry, I'm a real fan of The Who. Like, I follow The Who since 1979 religiously. And I'm as big a Who fan as there is. I got every copy with original mix on LP.
Purchase everything that they release?
On LP, I have. And I have with the original mix, and because all the CDs have been remixed.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I also have most of those. Actually, the only ones I don't have are the box sets because I can't afford them. But I have the old CDs like they did before they did the box sets. And so yeah, I got everything. And now they're telling me, you know, unless you have $400, you're relegated to the 2 CD set because yeah. You're just one of those fans. You're a fan, but you're not real. Sorry, but I am. But I don't have that kind of money. Who the fuck does?
They need the cash,
man. Anyways,
short on cash.
Oh,
that's it.
Let's move on because I'm mad at you now. I don't know why I'm mad at you, but I am.
Because I'm your default angle.
Yeah, my record company. Today's album, and I went way over time because I thought we were going to have like 40 minutes to talk about this because I got a lot to say. There's a lot. It's a very interesting album, background story and everything. We're going to get into it. We'll see how long it takes. Today's album we are reviewing is produced by the great Todd Rundgren, and it's by Marvin Adaye. Do you know who Marvin Adaye is?
No. I was going to say, his name sounds familiar, but it doesn't.
Yeah, it's Meatloaf.
Marvin Adaye?
You mean he wasn't called Meatloaf when he was born?
What were his parents thinking?
And the album is, of course, Bad Outta Hell from 1977. Some people may be find it strange that the album was released in 1977 because it didn't do anything until 1978. I think a lot of people think that it was released in 1978. It was not, you people.
No.
This is one of the, you know, we get so many fascinating, rock and roll is such a fascinating subject. Because, you know, you get an album like maybe from Frank Sinatra, who I love. But let's just say, what's the thing about Frank Sinatra's album? Oh, well, he had the orchestra in, and in the 3 days, and he put down a whole bunch of tracks for five albums. And that's the background story. There's not a lot of background story in other music, except
and then the rest of the year, he was drinking martinis and
exactly.
partying. And,
I mean, there's great stories about Frank Sinatra, but not a lot of great stories in general about albums. You know, first of all, they only existed since 1947, and really only existed since about 1955 when people started making albums instead of collecting singles to put on the albums. And so there weren't a lot, because it wasn't considered a serious art form. It wasn't until rock and roll in 1967 with Sgt. Pepper's and Pet Sounds in 66.
That's when people wanted to know, how are they recording these wonderful things?
And now it was about concepts and putting an album together artistically. And then that's where things got interesting. That's where things didn't just become, let's put a whole bunch of songs together. Because then there's no stories. There's really very little stories up until you get to the mid-60s and people started to take the album as an artistic art form. This is a fascinating album to read about because it had really everything against it.
They were working on it for a long time.
I'm going to go over really quickly. I don't even know why, but I'm going to go over really quickly about Meatloaf. Everybody knows about Meatloaf. But he started out, of course, as I said, is Marvin Lee Adaye, born in Dallas, Texas. He had an abusive father, and his mom died young, and then his father wanted him out for no other reason than that he didn't like him. So, you know, Meatloaf was on his own, and he wanted to be a Broadway star and sing and all that stuff. And he went to New York. He was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show in 1975, as everybody kind of knows. Bad Outta Hell is not his first album. His first album, and I don't have this ready, his first album he did with a woman called Sean Murphy in 1971, Meatloaf and Sean Stoney. I'm not making Meatloaf. Stoney and Meatloaf. Yes, with Meatloaf spelled as one word. Was released in September 1971 and included the single. You know the single. You tell me. What you see is what you get. I never heard it. I would be very interested to hear this album because a lot of people didn't even know this album existed. Even when Meatloaf was popular, because they didn't write about stuff like this until social media came along. So, and they were signed to Motown, of all things.
Yeah, that was a Motown record, that's all.
Yeah, very interesting. I would like to hear this album. I think it is available on the streaming services.
I saw
services.
On them on whatchamacallit.
Oh, you did?
It is on Spotify.
Yeah, I'd like to listen to it. I think it'd be very interesting. I think Sean Murphy is still around and still singing, but that was her really only claim to any kind of fame was singing on the side with Meatloaf. Anyways, Jim Steinman is the who also unfortunately has passed away along with Meatloaf. He was the guy who really he wrote the songs. It was he had the concepts for things, and him and Meatloaf got together, And as early as 1974 or 75, they were hatching this plan for this album called Bat Out of Hell that was going to be like a statement, I guess is what you could say. It's going to be a statement. And if you see, you know, Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell, it says on the album, it's not, it is Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell, but it's also...
it mentions Jim Steinman on
music
the front
by Jim Steinman or songs by Jim Steinman. I can't remember what it says. I even remember that.
Do you remember what they were going to call themselves before the record company intervened?
Yeah. And you know what? We're going to get to that because that's an interesting story, Rob. That's an interesting story, all of that. I just want to, before we get into the story of Bat Out of Hell from 1975 on, I'll just tell you my own experience. I do remember, just like the band last week, and this is so weird how I remember these things, but I remember the first time, and I was listening to my buddy Len Toussaint on the radio, early 1978, spring, maybe. I know that the weather was kind of nice. And he said, play his new albums. Not new albums, but new albums that kind of were making a noise type of thing. He would have that on Monday nights. And he said, well, I got this new album that's starting to make a lot of noise. And it's by not a band, he said. I remember he said that. And this is like 50 years ago almost. He said, not a band. It's a singer called Meatloaf. And this sounded really strange in 1970s. Like you can call yourself anything now, right? And nobody bats an eye, right? Nobody does anything. Back then, you had a weird name. It was like, what the fuck? Like, it just was, you just didn't have. So the guy's called Meatloaf. Well, what the fuck already? I don't like it because it's from the norm.
I thought, you know, he's a big guy called Meatloaf. Who's being that insulting? Who's, trying to...
See, I didn't even know that. Like, I just thought, well, maybe that's what he wants to be called, is Meatloaf, because it's a catchy name. Or something like that. I didn't even know he was a big guy, right? And he was just saying that this thing's starting to make waves, and we'll see how it does. And I think he played you took the words right out of my mouth. I think that's a song he played. And then he kept on playing the album every week, like on his show. And the album actually broke in Canada and England. The States, it took a long time. But Canada, and I think it was because of, it started in Toronto and then it went to other cities. So Canada was one of the ones who caught on. Nobody caught on at the beginning. When this was released in the fall of 1977, it just kind of sold a little bit.
It sold the first year about 100,000 copies.
Yes, which is respectable in a way.
But it's not what it ended up selling.
No. We're going to get to that, I tell you. I'll tell you right now. It's like one of the greatest selling albums of all time. I was going to have a list and I forgot. I always forget a tab. And that's a tab I forgot. It is the greatest selling debut album in the United Kingdom history. It has sold something. I wish I had this last night and I should have brought it up. 40 million records.
It's 47 million.
47. Thank you, Rob. 47 million records. One of the biggest albums of all time. It's one of the most infamous albums of all time. Everybody knows about Bat Out of Hell. And it all goes back to me remembering that one day when Len Toussaint said on the radio, I got this guy.
He's a little different.
Who would have known that this guy with the strange name would have one of the biggest albums in music history? I never would have known. And I'll tell you a quick story, again, personal, but I bought this album actually in that year, in the summer of 1978. What happened was I got one of those Columbia Records things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I got
12 albums for a penny.
I did. I got 12 albums for a penny. And one day I will tell you what 12 albums I bought. I have to really think. I can name about half right off my head, but I'd like to tell you all 12. But I tell you right now that Meatloaf was one of them because... These are albums that I got because I don't think I would buy them in the store, but I would buy them but I would get them if they were free, which means it's not a disparaging comment. It's just that I had no money. So the albums that I would buy in the store would have to be really special.
are the ones you definitely want for your collection.
Definitely.
This was just something you were curious about.
This was exactly. I was really curious about this album. And so I got it. And I've had that album in my collection for 10, 20, 30, 40, 45 years, since 1978 in my collection. And I'll tell you right now, even before reviewing it, because I'm not going to tell you how I felt about the album, but I have never had an album I've ever listened to in my whole life that I have been so divided about at different times. I have at times loved this album, and I have at times hated this album. And I have never had that happen. And I kind of came up, this week was very an epiphany type of moment where I had to listen to the album, right? And I had to decide, and I did decide how I felt about it finally. But I've never had an album where I really hated it sometimes and I really loved it sometimes.
Strange, a no middle ground album.
And I'm not talking about first that. Or not talking about first or third times. I'm talking about I listen to it 3 years later and I'm going, fuck, this is bullshit. Then I listen to it 2 years later on and go, oh, this is great. it is a dividing album. People either love this album or they hate it.
Yeah.
But let's get to the making of this album. It was written in 1975 by Jim Steinman. And the cool thing was that they would, and Ellen Foley even, people remember Ellen Foley as, I think, more now as being the person in Night Court.
Yeah, she was the first public defendant on Night Court before Markie Post.
No, second. Oh, was she first?
She was first before Markie Post.
I apologize. She was the first before. I thought she was cute.
All, well, I know all the fellas remember Markie Post. So.
Ellen Foley was cute too. She was skinny though.
Yeah.
Anyway, she was great. She was a great singer. She would actually, even at this point, they would play this. They would play this album in its entirety with Jim Steinman on the piano and Meatloaf singing, and then Ellen Foley doing her parts to. Every audition, and they got turned down by everybody. Can you imagine hearing this album with just piano and Meatloaf singing? I think it'd be stunning. But then again, I don't know what the atmosphere was like in the mid-70s. So I don't know if it came across weird with piano and Meatloaf singing, this very histrionic music, or if it came across weird. I have no idea, but it had to be an experience.
I think anyone listening to it would have a hard time getting a mental picture of the finished product from an audition.
An audition with piano and vocals. Even though they're playing the album from beginning to end, it had to be a strange experience. Anyways, one of the places they went to, and I love this story, is that they went to CBS. Could have been Asylum, but it says CBS because Clive Davis was there. And they played the whole album, just like I said, with the piano and Meatloaf singing right in front of them for 40 minutes. And you got to imagine this. You're singing Bat Outta Hell, and this is a song. You're singing the song Bat Outta Hell, and you finish that and you go, okay, Clive, that was the first song on the album and it's 10 minutes long. Now, here's the rest of the songs. It had to be a little bit like weird. So Clive Davis rejected it like everybody else did, except he was extremely rude about it. And I like Clive Davis. I've heard great stories about Clive Davis. But this was the kind of response I hate when people who don't play music.
Yeah, I feel they know something. Feel they know something should be put together,
and you should either do. Yeah, Clive Davis says actors don't make records. He told them right to their faces, and he says, "Do you know how to write a song?"
Are you an engineer?
Yeah, exactly. Goes right to Jim Steinman. Do you know how to write a song? Do you know anything about writing? If somebody said this, I'd punch him. I swear to God, I'd punch him. And Meatloaf did get mad. I don't know how mad he got, but he remembered it enough that in his autobiography, he wrote all about it. And he says, do you know anything about writing? If you're going to write for records, it goes like this. A, B, C, B, C, C. I don't know what you're doing. You're doing A, D, F, G, B, D, C, which actually it is. It's going all over the place. There's no rhyme or reason, but it works. So don't tell the artist what the fuck he should be doing, for one thing. Then he goes on, you don't know how to write a song. Have you ever listened to pop music? Have you ever heard any rock and roll music? You should go downstairs when you leave here and buy some rock and roll records. Now get the fuck out. Well, Meatloaf says, you know what? Jim at the time knew every record ever made. He was a walking rock encyclopedia. Although Steinman just laughed off the insults, Meatloaf screamed, fuck you, Clive, from the street to the building upstairs. Fuck you! And I would too. I would have done worse. I know how powerful Clive Davis is, and he can destroy your career. But if somebody, and you know, somebody told me that you shouldn't be playing music. He told us that you shouldn't even try. Anybody that says to any musician, I don't like your music, so don't play it. So like, don't be a musician.
I don't trust that person with anything they have to say.
Exactly.
That person is full of shit.
So this is the type of thing that they were coming across. But then, you know, it kind of got out, and Todd Rundgren liked it. Todd Rundgren heard the kind of, I guess, what they were doing. And Todd Rundgren said that this album's hilarious. He said he thought that they were doing a parody of Springsteen, which is, it's kind of like Springsteen, but it's like Springsteen on speed. So it's like Springsteen, but it's like, whoa, it's like really, really. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, they even wrote the songs before Born to Run became famous. So it can't have been really, it was just a coincidence. Plus, Roy Bittan and Max Weinberg do play on the album, so it sounds very Springsteen-like.
Yeah, I'd heard of Roy Bittan on this album, and then years later, and I found out he played in the E Street Band. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, you know what's surprising is that, first of all, for two guys who nobody has really heard of, they got all these people. They got Todd Rundgren to produce it.
They got Edgar Winter.
They got Edgar Winter. Who, you know what? I don't think this was listed on the album. I've had the album since 1978. I didn't know until this week that Edgar Winter plays the saxophone on it.
Yeah, because I've read these credits like hundreds of times.
Yeah. I don't think that it was. There's no way it was on the album, because I would have noticed it even in 1978. I would have noticed it. And so they got Edgar Winter. They got members of Todd Rundgren's Utopia playing on this record. What else? They got to record it in Woodstock with Albert Grossman, who was like the biggest manager ever, who had managed Bob Dylan. I mean, it seemed like they had all this power behind them, and yet they were these two guys who had no name. And it just seems strange to me. Like, how do you get Max Weinberg and Roy Bittan and all these guys?
Who brought all those guys in?
Yeah. I mean, how alone do you get and to get Todd Rundgren to produce your record? Like, fuck.
Well, I can see he heard it and had his curiosity.
Yeah, he said, this is unlike anything I've heard. This is so out there. I love it. This is like nothing I've ever heard. I got to produce this. So they started recording in late 1975, like I said, in Woodstock in Bearsville Studios, which was Albert Grossman's studio. But Bearsville, they needed more money for the album, and Bearsville wouldn't give it to them. So you know what? Todd Rundgren, he paid for the album, which, and I've heard bad stories about Todd Rundgren and his ego. It's even mentioned, I think, in here that they didn't know whether to pick Todd Rundgren because they had a choice. And they said, oh, we've heard about Todd Rundgren's ego, but I don't know, he seems to be really keen on it, so let's get him. But then you hear a story like this where he puts up all his money to finish this album, which is a really incredible thing. You imagine putting up your own money for your own album. I've done that every time. But to put up your own money for somebody else's album, holy smokes. So it was another E Street Band. I know this story's long, but we've already almost had an hour, and we haven't even gotten to how we think of the album. But it was actually another E Street Band member, Stephen Van Zandt, who contacted Cleveland International Records, a subsidiary of Epic Records, who got them to distribute the record, to deliver the record, and then the mixing is interesting. I'm sorry, but Rundgren initially mixed the record in one night, the whole thing in one night, but they listened to it, and the guys Steinman and Meatloaf weren't happy with the mixes. So Jimmy Iovine did, who's famous for everything, but he's a famous producer and entrepreneur or whatever, but he was just a kid back then. He remixed Two Out of Three Ain't Bad to what it sounds like now. And then a couple of songs were remixed, Paradise by the Dashboard Light and All Revved Up with No Place to Go. And Meatloaf and Jim Steinman mixed the title track, Bad Out of Hell. So Todd Rundgren mixed about three songs that he eventually got onto the album. So that's it about the making of the album. It's hard to believe that so many big people were involved in an album by a couple of nobodies. It must have been made quite an impression on people when they heard it, you know? So now we kind of get to the album, because there's not really too much to say. We could talk about the bullshit, like how it took this long to get going and blah, blah, blah. But anyways, when it got going, there were big albums in 1978. I remember, of course, the Grease soundtrack. That was me spitting the Grease soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
First two sides, I have no qualms about. But that's why. But the other two sides is
that's unforgivable.
Unforgivable. Never forgive Grease for that. So you got the Grease soundtrack. You still got Saturday Night Fever selling millions of copies, and now you got Bad Out of Hell just selling by the cartful.
I have a memory of somehow this being advertised on TV.
And it was advertised. They actually showed the special on TV in 1978, which I seen. They had which is very rare to show. They showed like, I don't know if it's a half an hour or an hour. They showed Meatloaf in concert playing this, at least in Canada. I don't know if they showed it in the States.
It wasn't a concert I saw.
But
TV commercials.
They did show TV commercials with clips from that concert. But Canada decided to show like the whole concert from a film. And anyways, that's the kind of imprint this album made. Is like people couldn't get enough. Like, oh, let's. But I do remember. Yeah, they did have commercials for this thing. You don't have commercials for albums very often.
I can't think of anyone else.
Alice Cooper had commercials for his albums.
Really?
Yeah, I've seen them on YouTube.
Okay, I haven't seen them.
Okay, you should look it up. It's
pretty. I'm guessing they're from like the early 70s. Are they from the mid to late 70s?
Yeah, I don't think they made. I don't think they started making commercials until Welcome to My Nightmare was the first time that I remember a commercial from any rock artist.
Weird.
Alice Cooper. Yeah. Talking about this album, I will start next week. You'll go first, okay? Because I've talked about this so much, I might as well finish it up somehow.
Just to get this out of your system, you'll explode.
I used to love the song "Bad Out of Hell" a lot. That was one of the songs I like, and now it just seems to be really. To be honest, everybody will admit this album is bombastic. It's huge. It's overdone. It's operatic. But that's what they wanted. It's not like this was a joke. This is what they were going for. They were going, you know, Jim Steinman's songs from Bonnie Tyler doing.
These sound like songs that should be in a musical.
Yes, they're songs that should be in an opera. They're that big.
Someone or in a big Broadway should musical. Be singing these in yes. a dramatic
and
fashion.
And that's why Bonnie Tyler sings the songs and Celine Dion sings Jim Steinman's songs is because they're meant for explosive over dramatics. And Meatloaf, who is an incredible singer, but is also overdramatic. But that's what this album wants to be. And it accomplishes that. But I don't... The one thing that I didn't like was Bad Out of Hell. The one thing that I did like before, I think because I've matured, I don't like the bombastic part of it. It's a little bit too much. It seems to go on for long. By the way, all the lead guitar on this record is by Todd Rundgren. Just wanted to put that in. If anybody's wondering, like, who's playing the vicious lead guitar in this album, it's Todd Rundgren. But I like so much of it. And you have to, like, I have to tell you, this is like the 50th time I've heard it in 45 years. So, but I haven't heard it in a long time. and this is the first time that I really had to take it 100% serious, other than just as, putting it on because I want to put it on, so I'll put it on. This was like, okay, you got to really know if you really like this record or not. After 40 years, 45 years, I had to decide whether I really like this record or not. And I did not know that. I swear to God, I've never had a record where I did not even know
if I liked the record. I've hated it at times.
I know.
What time is it now?
I liked that you took the words right out. I love that beginning. I remember hearing that beginning on the radio, and no song had a beginning like that on the radio in 1978 with the talking. And they would have that on the radio, and it would be so cool every time they played it. And I liked it. You took the words right out of my mouth. I like the piano Meatloaf songs. Heaven Can Wait. I really like that. Two out of three ain't bad. For crying out loud. I think those are the three, to me, and they're strange because they're the three songs, except for Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, which was a huge single. The other songs are songs that are the two songs not played on the radio, but I think they are the heart of this record. Those three songs are the heart of this record, and they're the least bombastic, and they're the ones that get to you the most.
That's my favorite song on the album.
Which one?
Heaven Can Wait.
Yes, I think Heaven Can Wait is my favorite song. I have to say, without trepidation, I think Heaven Can Wait is an amazing song.
It might be For Crying Out Loud for me, but lyrically, Heaven Can Wait, I like more.
Yeah, they're pretty close. I have to tell you, those three songs are just... And I remember, like... Two out of three ain't bad. We used to play at parties. They used to shut the lights off. Two out of three ain't bad. And all you would have would be these 11-year-old boys and girls just sitting around waiting for the lights to go on. Everybody thought something would happen. Nobody ever did. But that was just the song that they always turned the lights off for at the parties. Anyways, these three songs, I feel, are the centerpiece of the songs. I do like All Revved Up with No Place. I love Edgar Winter's saxophone on that. It's great. Paradise by the Dashboard Light, I don't think stands up as well. Again, the more bombastic it is, that's more I kind of pull back.
Also, the one that I've heard consistently on radio for 40 years. None of the other ones I've heard consistently.
Yeah, they do have an edited version, but a lot of times they would play the 8-minute version on the radio.
Of which, Battle to Hell?
Oh, no, Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They did have the two versions. And I remember that a lot of times it would be, sometimes it would, well, depending, if it was during the day, it would be the edited version. If you listened after 9 o'clock, they would play the unedited 8-minute version, which was better. I didn't know. Okay, this freaked me out. Another thing it took me 45 years to realize was that on Paradise by the Dashboard Light, it had that trick ending to it, which I didn't know. He's talking about, they're in the back of the car. They're in the back of the car, and she's going like, he's really horny. There's no other words to describe it. The singer's really horny, and he really wants to do it. And she's going, would you love me forever? Would you keep me? She's saying like, no, I'm not giving it out unless you promise to give me your whole future. And then finally, it even says in the lyrics, and I wasn't paying attention. I just thought it was all the same thing at the end, but it doesn't, because it kind of changes. Like, he finally goes, I can't take it anymore. Yes, you know, I forget what the words are. I should have it here, but he says,
now I'm praying for it. Well, that's that.
Yes, I'm praying for it. Now he goes,
that's the third part.
That's the last part that I'm talking about. And then he says, yes, yes,
I couldn't
yes.
take it any longer. God,
I couldn't take it any longer.
Feeling came upon me like a tidal wave. Yeah. I started praying to my God and on my mother's grave, swearing to my God.
Swearing to my mother's grave. I'll love you to the end of time.
I don't need to have the lyrics here. I know.
Very good, Rob. Thank you for bailing me out. And he says, I'll love you till the end of time. For sure. I'll love you till the end of time. And then there's the pause where he, you know what he does.
Yep.
Dun, 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 dun. And then he goes,
now I'm praying for the end of time.
I never knew that. In 45 years, I never knew that. I just kind of blissfully just thought he sang the same thing at the end, you know.
They were happy together now.
Saying, oh my God, I just did what I wanted to do, and now I want to get away from this woman.
He's not going to go back on what he said, but he does wish for the sweet release of death.
I do wish that death would come soon.
Oh, we've all felt like that. A woman is always, well,
It can be every now and then.
It works. The song works. It's just in my day and age now, I just don't like the bombast. And that's sometimes why I didn't like this record. I think was mainly Paradise by the Dashboard Light and Bad Out of Hell would rub me the wrong way at the wrong time when I would listen to it. And sometimes I would be receptacle to that. And I would go, oh, that's cool. So I actually really like this record, except for some of the bombast. And yes, it is extremely over the top. It's supposed to be, which is good, because if it's not, then it's a joke, right?
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be
go all the way.
You have to go. Well, you have to be in on the joke, or else you're going to lose it. You're going to lose the whole concept. I loved it. I give it 5.5 stars, even though I really didn't like Bad Out of Hell because it was really over the top. This record is almost saved by those three songs. Heaven Can Wait, 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad, For Crying Out Loud, are almost worth just the price of admission alone. And yet you still get Paradise by the Dashboard Light and All Revved Up with No Place to Go. And you took the words right out of my mouth. Those are pretty good add-ons to three super songs already. I finally decided after 45 years, this is a 4.5 star record. I still have to be in the mood to play this. You have to be in a little bit of a demented, I want to hear big bombastic stuff type of mood to hear this record. This is not a record if you're down and out and you want to, you listen to your cool jazz Miles Davis when you're in that mood. This is the music you listen to when you've, I don't know, when you're really up.
Yeah. This is up music. This is, I can't describe it.
You know what? I can't describe it other than because I've never heard it. The only records I've even heard that are like this are Jim Steinman produced records, like Celine Dion and Bonnie Tyler, and Bad Out of Hell 2, which, by the way, is we've talked about great comebacks. We talked about two of the greatest comebacks in music history. The third is Bad Out of Hell, where Meatloaf was almost back to complete obscurity. And then he releases Bad Out of 2, and it does almost as well as Bad Out of 1. And it's just, I think, even though it's way too long, because of the CD era, they decided to make Bad Out of Hell 2 like 70 minutes long or some outrageous thing, where a really big, boisterous album like that should be 40 minutes. Way too long. But I think it's even a better album than this. I haven't listened to it a long time, but it's killer songs, and it deserved to put Meatloaf back into the position that he has held to this day, even after death. Thank God for Bad Out of Hell 2, because it made him the legend that he is. Bad Out of Hell should have made him a legend, because it sold like one of the top 20 selling albums of all time. But it really was Bad Out of Hell that that cemented that and said, oh my God, yeah, he can do it again. He did it again. How does a guy replicate? Of course, that's Jim Steinman writing songs. How do they replicate that again?
Do the same thing. Did they have Todd Rundgren producing that one?
No.
Okay.
No.
Too bad.
I forgot. I got to look that up. Who produced that? I'm going to look that up while you give me some more what you thought of the record.
I thought the record had a red album cover, and there was a motorcycle, and there was a bat.
Was there songs that you didn't particularly...
Nope.
Nothing really offended you and say, that's too much. That's too much.
I have one criticism to offer, but I'll get to that after I talk about the album.
Okay.
My older sister and older brother both had copies of this album, and this is one of the first ones that I started listening to when I started getting into music. And the nice thing about it had all the lyrics, and there were lots of lyrics on the liner.
Yeah, that's true. It did, yeah.
And all I can tell you is I've heard this album, at least 50 times.
Oh, just as much as I did, yeah.
Yes, and I absolutely love this album. When I listened to it again for the first time, I realized this is on my list of top 5 Stranded on a Desert album.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well.
This is in there.
Totally surprised, because I would have had no idea, and I've known this guy forever. No. I have never known that.
This is an easy 5 out of 5 for me. I absolutely love this album from start to finish. The one criticism I might have to offer is some of the lyrics can be a bit clunky, but not in any way enough to be distracting from the album.
I think everybody will have to admit that at times the lyrics are, because there's so many.
Yes.
And some of them can be a little bit broad.
Not as well thought out.
Not as well thought
out. They feel to me like, you know, they got maybe crammed in there or put in there last minute to finish the song.
Right.
But not a lot of them, a few. And on the love it or hate it part, whereas I love this album, I used to jam with a guy, we'll call him Little Rob for now.
I know Little Rob by the way.
10 years older than me. He grew up in Oshawa, Ontario there. He absolutely hates this album with passion.
There are people who hate this album more than they hate any other album in the world.
The reason he hates this album is because he was in his formative teen, early 20 years in 78 when it was being played all the time, and that's why he hates it. That one summer where it got played and played drove him nuts.
Hey, I was listening to music since. Continually during that year too. And you know what? The strange thing,
for him, it was too
much.
The
only song I can remember, we just did this too, the only song, and I even mentioned it, that ever bugged the shit out of me was played all the time. And my whole life was Three Times a Lady. Because I swear.
Yeah, I can see that.
Three Times a Lady every like second hour, and it was so long. Like I told you, it was like a long ballad, and even they edited it, and it was still like 5 minutes long.
It's just because it's so damn slow.
And it's so slow and it's so sappy. It was the only song that I remember kind of liking at the beginning and then quickly getting sick of. But I never, like, I remember I lived through those times when Saturday Night Fever was played continuously. Grease was played continuously. That same summer, Bat Out of Hell was played for the whole year. And I never got tired of it.
I didn't get a chance to hear it on the radio.
And I tell you right now that I highly doubt that Little Rob listened to the radio as much as I did back then, because I listened to it almost every second that I wasn't at school. So, but I do understand. Yeah, I do understand his point.
Reemphasizes of view. The you love it or you hate it.
Yes, and
this is
it is true. Sometimes you can come up to somebody and you can like the same music, and all of a sudden you mention Bat Out of Hell, and you go, fuck, that album's a classic. And he goes, I want to fight you right now.
Are you insane? Do you hear the same album I heard? Well, maybe yours was scratched. I don't know.
I'm going to make you hate this album. By the way, Bat Out of Hell 2 was produced by Jim Steinman.
Okay.
Which is interesting, because I actually think that Bat Out of Hell 2 is very close to being as good as Bat Out of Hell. And and the album, unfortunately, is almost twice as long as Bat Out of Hell, which I think was, to me, its undoing. But I haven't heard it in a long time. I'm anxious to listen to Bat Out of Hell 2 again, because it is a fantastic record.
Okay.
If you like Bat Out of Hell, Bat Out of Hell 2 is even more huge.
I just heard the two or three radio songs on it.
Mm-hmm. But just like Bat Out of Hell, there are some really cool hidden songs on there.
Okay.
So I highly recommend it. If anybody likes Bat Out of Hell, which we do, we seem to both love it. Definitely,
yep.
Rob.
Yep.
I have finally, so strange, I was in that category of being both those guys. Love and hate.
Love and hate.
Love and hate. And I came after 45 years to the realization that yes, I think this is close to a masterpiece, but I think because of the clunky lyrics and the overproduction, which is on purpose, but that doesn't mean I like it sometimes. It just gets that last half a star it doesn't get. It gets 4.5.
For me, I found it wasn't enough to distract me. I have good feelings all the way I hear this album, and on other songs, I have better feelings.
So you like every song in the album in one way or another, right?
Yes.
I like that. You know what? We haven't found too many albums that you have liked like that. To be honest with you, you've given five stars that I've just loved.
Yeah, but this one, it is a sense of familiarity, is an early impression of
there was never anything to make me feel down about this album. It was always, I enjoyed listening to it. It was a really incredible work to listen to. And when I started listening to a bunch of other stuff, a bunch of other stuff paled in comparison to this in my mind. It was strange.
Yeah, it's... there's nothing
I thought
like
all
it.
Music should there's be
there's nothing
big.
Like it. There's it's so big. It's just I can't describe it other than it's a big, boisterous, loud album, and yet it has its soft parts. But by loud, I mean it's in your face, and either you like that or you think like you're in my space. Get out.
Yeah, the singing wise, this is not an album where you have any trouble understanding what's being said, because these guys are actors. They're theater people. They have to make sure that the words get through when they sing.
Bad Outta Hell is the sixth biggest selling album of all time. Sixth.
I heard it was the biggest selling album in Australia.
That's the thing. Yes, it is. I did read that. You jogged my memory, because I have to read so much stuff that sometimes it takes something to jar into my head.
I have a
head.
quick read through and just a few tidbits here and there.
You don't have to read everything, which is good. You read little things, and I seriously sometimes, like last week, I read like 40 articles on Robbie Robertson, and that was just the articles that I had to read about his, that happened because of how he passed away. I still had to read some other stuff just to,
for and, the album, yeah,
and so sometimes there's just too much and I can't remember everything. But it's the sixth greatest selling album of all time.
On
like,
Earth.
Like, that's on Earth in the history of making albums. 43
million,
43 million copies. Wow. Unbelievable. If you're interested, a couple of the albums, I'm not going to say all the albums that are ahead because I don't like all of them. Thriller's the greatest selling album of all time at 70 million. Fuck, 70 okay. million albums. No comments on that about Michael Jackson. But actually, it's a great album. It's a classic album. Back in Black is the second greatest album
of all
time.
Yeah, that one I'd heard was in the top three.
Da-da-da. that's what my nephew, my great nephew, knew the chords to that, like what I just did. Da da da. Da 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 da. Da 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 da. When he was like a year and a half. That's how Back in Black has become like ingrained in
human
the parents. Yeah, in human like terms, as far as it captures everybody, no matter what age they're at. Bodyguard for Whitney Houston, number three. Number four, Dark Side of the Moon, 45 million, the same as the body. I don't know how the Bodyguard got 45. All it had was I Will Always Love You. And anyways, sorry all you Whitney Houston fans. But yeah. Fuck. And the one album that's before, which I don't even count, because first of all, it's the Eagles.
Oh, the greatest hits album.
The greatest hits album. Yeah. It's the greatest hits album, which shouldn't count because you put nothing into it other than putting your greatest hits on it. And that's 44 million. And that's just
that
one.
That kind of says that people want those songs and they don't want your other songs.
Yeah. But you know what? Meatloaf's Bookend by both the Eagles. Got the Eagles' greatest hits. He's right
and
there
Hotel
at number
California
seven.
At eight.
And Hotel California is at eight. So you can't say, oh, they didn't like the regular albums because Hotel California.
Okay, I withdraw that previous statement.
So there you go. I remember the biggest selling album of all time at one point was Saturday Night Fever. That's all people talked about in 1978. And now it's at 40 million. So times just change.
Carole King was once on top.
Yeah, Carole King was once on top, as was, you know, Frampton Comes Alive and
Frampton
Rumors.
Comes Alive, yeah. That one was
That was so huge. You had to, I know most of you people have lived through that period. I think that's most of our audience. But man, that album was, I even remember as a kid and not really being into music, but every morning my mom would have, as she was making breakfast for us to go to school, every morning Peter Frampton was on the radio when I was like 9-8 years old. Like every morning, and it was like, it's like that's all anybody talked about. You have to understand that there is a period, and I did look through this, I know we're running long here, but there is a period when albums were big, it took up the whole culture, like not just music culture, It took up everything. Everybody talked about it. Oh, everybody seemed to have an album. And when I did like this thing, which I was just doing about the greatest selling albums, five of them out of the top one, two, three, four, five, I think this is 10, five of them come from just the period, six of them come from 76 to 78. So in that time period,
wow,
that's when people just bought albums like they would buy like furniture.
You know? Our modern music renaissance.
There. It was a modern music renaissance. It all started really with Frampton Comes Alive. You could say Tapestry, but after Frampton Comes Alive, there was always two or three albums a year that were huge. And then that kind of died by the time the early 80s came along. But that period from 75 to 80, holy fuck, when an album was big, like you were a millionaire 100 times over by the time it was done selling.
Yeah, they were real blockbusters.
And you couldn't get it off the radio. You released five singles off an album that was big. You didn't get it off the radio for a year and a half.
That's what killed Phil Collins.
Yeah, fuck. I'll kill Phil Collins. See, I shouldn't say that, because if he dies tomorrow, who are they going to look at?
And he used his mind to do it. His mind. Well, we've got to stop his mind.
Okay. Well, again, it's a regular show. Way over time.
Way over time. So it's the right time.
Now, next week, we will have another Todd Rundgren-produced album from the 1970s. It's a very interesting album. And we will have some more anti-Semitic comments.
Bloody Samites. Manufacturing their luggage. Oh no, that's Samsonite.
Samsonite. You are also anti-Samsonite.
Anti-Samsonite, yes. Those sons of bitches. They only had to screw me over once.
Anti-Samsonite. I've never heard that. We should get that going. We should make that a thing.
Yeah, Samsonites. They'll think it's a biblical thing.
So until next week, everybody, take care and stay safe. Just later on. Saying a bunch of gobbledygook and then just saying paper and pork. What the fuck's wrong with you?